Good morning, everyone. It's a delight to see all of you this morning and to see all of you survive the wind yesterday afternoon. And yesterday I had this reflection because I think this is the first time we've done a retreat kind of in the middle of the winter, at least for me here. And at first I was concerned because it does take a lot more effort in terms of dealing with your shoes outside and the wind and then the concerns about the drifting snow. And it's not even snowing, right? This is just, we have pretty good weather. And at the same time, I was delighted by it because sometimes there's something nice about putting forth the effort of really being here. I think it can really show and help us with our dedication for exploring this, which is so important, this quality of patient perseverance around this, because it's not always easy. So I am touched that you came back. So, yeah. In the Zen tradition, and I know this is for, I think it's in both the Rinzai Zen tradition and the Soto Zen tradition, these are two schools of Zen. The traditional way of entering a monastery is so different than the way we invite people into practice here, which is that a young monk will go to a monastery and request to be admitted to the monastery to practice. And the traditional response is, too bad, we don't have room. And so then the monastic has to sit, you have to sit with your hands in a particular way. So you're in a bowing position outside the monastery gates. And usually it can be, sometimes it's just a few hours or up to a day. And then traditionally they'll say, well, you could come in and stay the night, but you have to, after breakfast, you have to go immediately out back on the steps. And there can be a number of days of that. And then finally they'll say, well, you can come. And there are some semblances sometimes in American Zen around this. You can come in and then you have to sit for 3 days in a room. And then after that, they think, oh, okay, so maybe you can give it a try here. We haven't decided to incorporate something like that yet. You never know. But I think there's something about, you know, of course, it's a little bit extreme. You know, Japanese culture can be extreme in all kinds of ways. But there's something about that you've probably noticed, especially for those of you who've practiced for a while, this does take a kind of perseverance to it, this repetition of coming back to this practice again and again, not in some kind of forceful way, really in a very gentle way. But as I was saying yesterday, it's just this willingness to be present that we're exploring and remembering that. And it takes a persistence. And I think that kind of cultural entry in Japanese Zen exemplifies that in an externalized way, as far as that goes. And I know it's quite different than here. We want to be so welcoming. But there's something so important about that effort to make this happen. So it's I'd say it's a little bit different than other spiritual traditions in the sense that, I'm not trying to criticize this other narrative that we find in another spiritual tradition. I think there's value just from a different perspective. But, you know, the whole idea of being saved by someone or some deity is really different than this. This is so much of, at least the narrative of early Buddhism, and again, this changes in later Buddhism, is it's this shaping model of really through our efforts of coming back again and again, even if it's the effort of surrendering, is really what is going to change the heart and mind. And that's where I'd like to begin, is just to review a little bit what we went over yesterday and maybe over a little bit Friday night as well. And just to fit that in, Friday night I gave you that quote from Aristotle and his understanding of ethics, you know, that underlies his understanding of ethics, which is that excellence in this form of being a human being is a habit, not an act. And I really appreciate that, because it fits with what we're doing here. And the habit that we're engaging in, which I went over yesterday, is just this willingness to be present. Keeping it very simple. And for those of you who came to the preliminary, more of the detailed instructions for the sitting meditation and walking meditation, you might recall so much of the foundation of this willingness to be present is feeling into the body, feeling the breath, for example, in the sitting meditation, which I find so helpful to come back to the body, or the feeling of the body moving as you're walking, or the sensations on the bottoms of the feet. So we have this basis to shape these hearts and minds in a different manner. And also, as I mentioned yesterday, just to review, that I mentioned that there are these two aspects of this willingness to be present. The one is to simply be aware of what's going on, the remembering, like feeling the breathing, that after-the-fact mindfulness. Oh, interesting. Oh, anger was just happening. Oh, interesting. That was that story had that flavor to it. Oh, and it feels like this. And we take a little pause with that, and then we come back to the feeling of the breathing. So it's just being aware of what's going on. Stepping out of being lost in the content, for example, of the thinking or feeling the bodily experience of our experience. And then there was the other aspect, and I shared with you that image, the archetypal image of the grandparent, you know, that has so much love for the grandchild, holds the grandchild in such deep qualities of kindness and compassion, but is not so swayed by the grandchild and what children do. Like, there's the wisdom of being through that so many times, that there's so much of a broader understanding of that and not being so shaken by that or reactive. So it's that quality of okayness or acceptance. And then yesterday afternoon, we came back to that with this notion of equanimity, which I said I would come back to this morning, which I really want to take some time on, because it really is that the word we could use for that, the embodiment that comes from the archetypal grandparent that we're also bringing. So it's not only just being aware, but having and cultivating this sense of okayness. So I do want to go over what it is and what it isn't, equanimity, and how to cultivate it. Again, this notion of cultivation that I went over yesterday. And I find that it's such an important state of mind, both on the individual level and the collective level for these present times. You know, for some of you, just reflecting, you know, individually, you know, I'm sure there's some of you out there that are faced with all kinds of challenges and situations that, you know, that elicit from your mind all kinds of flavors of unhelpful reactivity in your mind. You know, that keep you up awake at night or crowds your mind with thoughts that seem to keep on rolling on and on and on. And it could be issues, you know, around your health. It could be issues in terms of different relationships in your family, whether it be at the workplace or relationships with family or friends that crowd the mind in these ways. And then on the collective level, you know, we're faced with a whole host of different issues, whether it be environmental catastrophe or systemic racism or systemic sexism or patriarchy, whatever it is, there's these huge challenges that we're confronted with. And in many ways, this is just the nature of living, isn't it? Is these challenges, both individually and collectively. Like, it's always been this way for our human species, is to face challenges. This is the human predicament. And when I take this in, I reflect on the Buddha's life, to remember that even after he was fully awakened, there's all kinds of challenges that he had to face, all kinds of difficulties that he was confronted with. You know, a family member, his cousin, tried to kill him, tried to completely undermine his monastic community. So he's dealing with that. And it wasn't only his cousin, but then there was a lot of the Brahmins really dedicated to the rabbinical tradition that felt like he was threatening their spiritual practices. So there was a lot of disputes and horrible things being said about the Buddha throughout his life. You know, it's you know, sometimes we can see, we imagine somebody who's fully awakened that once you get to that point, just people say nice things about you all the time. Wouldn't that be great? But that wasn't the case. Indeed, he was faced with all kinds of criticisms. You know, and there was still a lot of violence and war during that time, a tremendous amount, even towards his clan, the Sakyan clan. You know, later on, you know, basically his almost his entire clan was wiped out by this prince, Virudhaba, really as a revenge tactic. And to really be alive and to go through that. So just to point out that this is the human experience. And this practice is about navigating it differently. So what is equanimity? What is this quality? And I'd like to begin in a different way, is just to invite you to see these different statues. You know, we have the statue of the Buddha over here, and then a statue of Kuan Yin, and then another image of the Buddha up here, you know, in this touching the earth mudra. And in particular, what I invite you to notice, and some of you might not be able to see all of these, but just also seeing the differences in terms of and the similarities between the posture of Kuan Yin and also the posture of these of the Buddha statue and the Buddha behind me here. And what do you see? You know, what do you see about those postures? What are they conveying to you? The positions of those bodies.
They look at rest, at peace.
At rest and at peace. Great. Yeah.
And solid.
And I think these two are really important: rest and a peace, and solid, and composed. Yeah.
Very mindful.
What say?
Very mindful.
Mindful. Isn't it interesting that a posture of a body can convey to us that quality of mindfulness? Yeah.
Very upright and open.
Upright and open. Yeah. 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 And what I want to point out is that these images, I think, they can really convey some of these qualities that we're cultivating, like equanimity, which I find interesting just to remember. And I think that's why art is so important, especially you could call religious art, because it conveys to us something of on so many different dimensions. I think that's why they always say, you know, a picture is worth 1,000 words. It's just, it's amazing what we can get from these images. And for me, in all of these, they do convey this particular quality of equanimity, like some of the words that were used, like solid, composed, yet still. And then also this just juxtaposition, which I appreciated you mentioning. There's an uprightness, and there's also an openness. And as I go through some of these, you know, particular qualities of equanimity, you might see how they're reflected in these postures, in these bodies that are conveying all kinds of things to us. So the first quality that I want to come back to is basically this word solid or stability. There's something stable about that posture, isn't there? And what I find, this quality of equanimity has that sense of stability, but not in a rigid or collapsed way. So I think that's why the word open is really important. There's a different sense of really what equanimity is about. the image that I find also helpful, or the metaphor around equanimity to give the sense that it's not rigid or collapsed but still responsive, is how the ballast of a ship works. And when you imagine, I think they used to put lead in the bottoms of ships, where, I don't know what they use now. I don't know. What? They still use lead. Oh, wow. Wow. And it's amazing how that works, right? Because once you have the weight, that weight at the bottom of the ship, it allows the boat to be incredibly responsive to all the waves that are happening. And it's that ballast that allows it to stay upright. But it's not some rigid system. It's a system that allows for a stability, and it's stable because it's responsive. And equanimity has this quality. There's a stability, but not a rigid one. One that can still be responsive rather than reactive. And equanimity opens the doorway for me in my life to it being able to respond rather than merely react. And I think this is the beauty of equanimity. And then it helps distinguish the things that we can get equanimity confused with. For example, in a little bit in later Buddhism, in Theravada Buddhism, there's this whole, as what happens in spiritual traditions, this commentarial tradition. And there's this text, the Visuddhimagga, which plays a huge role in Buddhism in Thailand and in Burma and in Southeast Asia and Sri Lanka. And I love how they define some of these states of mind, because they give what they call the near enemies and the far enemies. So the far enemy of a quality of mind is the opposite of it. So the far enemy of equanimity is pretty easy, because I just mentioned it. It would be reactivity. If I'm not equanimous, the far enemy really is aversion and grasping, kind of the aversion of pushing away, or the grasping of pulling in unskillful ways. That's the far enemy. That would be the opposite of it. You know, just as the opposite of compassion is cruelty, you know, that would be the opposite of it. And then the near enemy is the thing that we get that quality confused with, that heart quality confused with. So equanimity, the near enemy is indifference or apathy, because they can look the same, but they're very different. And we can so easily get them confused. I remember noticing this. I was at a conference on trauma, and there was a person there that was part of the conference who was being labeled as this very calm, peaceful, steady, stable person. And they weren't. They were just disconnected and checked out. They just looked that way. There was almost no affect because of the challenges that they had faced in their life. That's different. Disconnection is different than equanimity. And you'll hear other aspects of equanimity that will really clarify this. So that's the near enemy, indifference, apathy, or this disconnection. That's not what we're talking about. It's more like there's another Pali word, or Pali phrase that's used for equanimity, tatra majjhatatta. And it literally means standing in the middle of all this, or there in the middle. And I love that phrase, because it has that sense of still being in the middle of it all, but being okay. And it gives a sense of being there rather than being disconnected. And again, to me, this is the heart quality of equanimity. So this is one aspect of equanimity, stability, or the other word that was used was solid, yet a kind of open quality, a responsive quality. And then another quality is clarity, that this is an equanimity based on seeing the way things are. This is what we're doing here, right? The mind's lost in thought, and then you pause and you actually notice what has been going on. It's not just the breath. You actually feel what the breath is like in this moment. It's not like you're just going for a walk. You actually experience what that's like. mean, it's such a rich world, walking, the activity of walking. There's such a fullness there. So there's clarity that we're looking for, not this disconnection. And the Buddha points to this when he talks about two different kinds of equanimity, what he calls household equanimity and renunciation equanimity. And household equanimity, he says, is just being blind to the world, blind to the dangers out there. So more like the example of the person at the trauma conference, just checked out. That would be household equanimity. But he said, that's not true equanimity. True equanimity is what he'd call renunciation equanimity. And he's using this term renunciation in the sense of referring to someone on the spiritual path. So it's the equanimity of that we're exploring here. That is based on seeing the way things are, which we're doing moment after moment here. So it has a clarity to it. It's not checked out. It's stable. It's solid. Right? So it has a quality of open or mindful, but also stable. And it's different to have equanimity when we see a situation for what it really is and to touch that. Joanna Macy, that's a talk we'll get on Thursday night. I get confused on the talks I've given where. She's this really this one of our wise elders in this tradition of being a Dharma teacher, but also an environmental activist that brings great vision to our current times. And she said once, to give full attention to the perils confronting our world invites an almost excruciating tension. It is the tension between seeing the enormity of the peril, such as climate chaos, mass extinctions, the potential of nuclear warfare, and seeing the inadequacy of our response to it. It takes courage to endure these tensions, yet endure them we must. For to be conscious enough to act responsibly requires being awake to the possibility of failure. That's a radically different way of moving in the world, is moving forward and knowing the possibility of failure, knowing and feeling often the inadequacy of our responses. Because we usually don't do that, whether it be individually or collectively, right? This is what I notice about my mind, is there's some kind of blind hopefulness where I think I can change my life and change my world in it more of in a fairy tale. And there's this pushing forward, or there's a complete collapse when I'm faced with the feeling of inadequacy. So it's just this ping-ponging back and forth rather than having the equanimity of really seeing the way things are and moving forward. That's the equanimity of clarity and stability, and it has a responsiveness to it. So I want to share with you an example of this kind of profound equanimity that can come in the face of such tension. And this is a story about Ajahn Suchito, who's a monastic in the Thai forest tradition. And he's really, this is maybe in the 70s now, maybe 80, but he's still teaching and really I love being on retreat with him just because it's so great to be around him. There's really just such a quality to his practice. And, you know, he's been in robes since his, you know, probably for close to 50 years now. And he was on a pilgrimage in the monastic tradition. Monks will go on something called tudong, which is they basically just traveling around by foot, and then they sleep wherever they are, and often they're going to pilgrimage sites, or they're just walking around and begging, and then they sit and sleep wherever they find themselves. And he was with his attendant, and they were walking through India and Bihar. And Bihar is known for, it's just a very poor province of India, and there's a tremendous amount of crime and violence. And they were walking, and they were accosted by actually a whole gang of people who were just out there to prey on people, you know, traveling through the area to steal things from them and to mug them. And so they had these people with weapons on them. And this is Ajahn Suchito's description of what had happened. He said, you know, after they were accosted, he said, "I was being lugged in two directions simultaneously, one by the strap on my water bottle and one on my bag," because they were like pulling him, you know, trying to get his things. "And I could only try to get the stuff off and let them have it, but their pulling on it made that impossible. We were going round in circles with their excitement spinning in the frenzy. I had to stop this." And he was thinking, wait, let me get this stuff off. Momentarily, they stood still. They all had axes and staves. And the leader glared at me through twisted features and raised his axe. Funny how your mind goes clear when the options disappear. So why struggle against the inevitable? So I just want to be clear. So here's somebody brandishing an axe toward him, about to kill him. And so he thought, the only freedom was to go without fear. So I bowed my head and pointed to the top of my skull toward him and drew the blade of my hand along it from my crown to the brow of my head. Hit right here. Something shifted. He backed off, waving his axe and muttering angrily. I stepped forward and repeated the action. Give it away, let it all go. Things settled. He lowered his axe. I slipped off the bag and the water bottle and stepped back. The three of them began excitedly picking over the treasure. And then they left. That's equanimity. And do you hear the clarity? Like, and it came to him all of a sudden around his impending death. And for him, what was so clear is about how he wanted to die. Well, I'm not going to die with fear. Do you see the lack of, when there's not the reactivity, he was able to actually respond in a way and just to be open to the moment. So how to practice this, how to nurture this quality of the heart, equanimity. And there are many ways to do this, and we're just practicing one way of doing this through this particular way of meditating. As I said, some of what we're cultivating here is the equanimity towards our minds. As I shared with you, you know, that quote from the Dhammapada, you know, what is often our greatest enemy? These minds. What is often our greatest asset once it's cultivated are these minds. And that's why it's so important that we're here, we're paying attention to the feeling of the breathing, really checking it out, becoming curious about it, so we can start to sink into the present moment. And then when the mind gets lost in a different sensation, maybe it's an unpleasant sensation, to be with that, but also to notice how the mind is reacting to that. Oh, it's not liking it. Interesting. Oh, it's afraid because now there's this unpleasant sensation. Interesting. Let me be with this. That's what's going to cultivate equanimity. Because again, we're exploring a particular component of our experience, the subject of suffering around it. We're almost guaranteed to have to be confronted in our lives with unpleasant sensations. It's this opportunity to start to cultivate some equanimity around those unpleasant sensations. And yes, it's true, it's an art. There's times where our minds and hearts get worn out by being with those unpleasant sensations, and then we have to do something different. It's not denying that. But this is where there can be a taste of freedom. And not only around unpleasant sensations, it can be the thoughts and emotions that bombard us. To have that quality of that moment, it could be the after-the-fact mindfulness. Oh, this is what's going on. Oh, interesting. Oh, yeah, anxiety. Yeah, it feels like this. So this willingness to see that quality of equanimity, clarity, and to be with it. To touch into that, not in a way that we're getting overwhelmed. Being overwhelmed by experience doesn't cultivate equanimity. So sometimes, of course, we need to take a break, but it's stretching into experience to cultivate that quality of equanimity. And also for the pleasant experiences, so often we think of equanimity around that which is unpleasant. But when you really start to examine your experience, you'll notice that around pleasant experiences, we actually have a hard time really being kind of upright and open towards pleasant experiences. They shake us. We see them and then we get so excited that we're not with the pleasant experience anymore. We're just thinking about it, you know, or actually reacting to it. We're not letting it in. It's too much for the heart. When there's equanimity, the heart can be open to this world. Seeing reactivity around pleasant experiences is a little bit more difficult, but it's there because we can't actually fully take that in. It requires equanimity for us to really fully be there. So again, it's just the slight turn in the rudder, the willingness to turn the rudder, just that. And to keep it simple, like the instructions are very simple for today, just like yesterday. Feeling the breathing, being with that, feeling the body moving, noticing what happens when the mind gets lost. Allowing it to be messy, right? We're out in the fields. It's messy out there, you know? It can be really muddy. Reminds me, I worked on a farm in New Hampshire for a year. It was after college. I had this idealized vision of what it would be to be a farmer. 1 year of that an organic farm with not a lot of tractors and things like that. But I remember it was a really wet season, and so often it was just walking through the mud and dealing with the fields that way. And practice can feel that way. That's the way it is. But it's, again, it's just that simple turn of the rudder. Because we're opening up a really small space to respond differently to our experience. Again, we don't have to look for the dramatic in our lives. I feel like, especially in this place that we currently call the U.S., there can be such an emphasis on the dramatic, and especially in spiritual traditions, looking for the dramatic spiritual experience. But there are small things that are changing in your life, probably, that are actually significant. It's a significant thing to, I think, for me to have an undramatic conversation with somebody I'm having a hard time with. That's what I'm looking for. And it can allow for something radically different to happen, I think, in our communities as well. Opening up the space for, again, for responding. So another story of opening up this space of responding, maybe not as dramatic as the Ajahn Sucitta one. This is the problem, is we always look for dramas because you have teachers to give you these dramatic examples that are so outside of our thing. It's the problem. It is. You really beware of teachers like that. They lead you astray. I mean, I think this is in some ways dramatic in its own way, but in a quiet way, which I really appreciate. And this happened actually quite a few years ago now in Flagstaff. So what had happened was there was a court case. What had happened in one of the bars in Flagstaff, actually it might have even been a police officer, that a woman was sexually assaulted in a bar. And there was a case around this man, and the court case, the man, the perpetrator was actually clearly convicted of this crime. So the case was concluded, the jury came out, it's very clearly convicted that the sexual assault had happened. So there wasn't any question. It was actually a very easy case. But then this judge then went out of her way to blame the victim of this crime, that she shouldn't have been there, she shouldn't have been wearing the clothes that she was wearing, kind of the typical patriarchal narrative around this, which I just want to point out the outrageousness of this. You know, we don't, you know, usually give people, when there's a drive-by shooting or somebody robs their house, you know, you get your house robbed, you don't get a lecture for not having an alarm or something like that. It's just, it's placing the blame in the wrong place. So it was outrageous. And of course, as a result of this, there was outrage nationwide. This is something that was covered nationally because how outrageous it was, especially from a judge. Right? So a judge has a particular role, and they did not do their job. So it was incredibly contentious. And in the midst of this, actually one of the my wife's colleagues in the same agency that she worked in had this idea, and she had some connections, so she spoke to a judge that in the state of Arizona that was responsible for these kind of continual education credits and things like that for judges, and through a conversation with him was able to mandate a particular education around sexual assault. And as a result of that, I think it was statewide, what started to happen was a mandated class around these kinds of dynamics and getting educated about this. And, you know, it was a whole process. She got other organizations involved that specialize in training judges to make this happen. And to me, this is the wisdom of equanimity. You know, she didn't get lost in the outrage. She reflected on how can she move in the world in an effective way. She actually didn't even start a fight. And there's a place for outrage in fights. I'm not trying to say that there isn't, but there's something so wise about this, to figure out where is an opportunity here to make a difference that really has an impact. equanimity allows me to move in the world in this way. Because outrageous things happen on a daily basis, and we're filled with reactivity. And I'm not quite sure if it's helpful for us to merely act out of that. We've had, you know, centuries and thousands of years of this in our species. And the spiritual path offers something different, I think. So again, this quality of equanimity, and we have this opportunity today just to nurture it, just to provide the conditions for that plant of equanimity to begin to grow. And what are the conditions? This willingness to be present, this curiosity about your experience, cultivating this quality of okayness so that plant can continue to grow in our lives. And remember, with this willingness to be present, it's to remember again the quality of effort, coming back again to review, just touching your hands. This has to be so easeful. It's the remembering rather than the forcing. I think sometimes that's why this quality of surrender can really fit for people, because sometimes we've learned so much of efforting in our lives. What we need to do is learn how to step back and more rest in being present rather than forcing it. This is what I appreciate about the Kuan Yin practice, is it's allowing my body to go downward so there's an opening or a surrendering. And it's through that that something different can emerge. Okay, so if you need to just stretch your legs just for 30 seconds, and then we're just probably going to sit for 5 minutes as a way of us entering into our day together of practice. Okay, so let's begin to sit together just for about 5 minutes, and then we'll move into the walking meditation.